Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We rely on writers to capture the feeling of place and people and communicate those feelings to the world. In this episode, we talk with investigative journalist Ken Ward, who recently won a MacArthur Fellowship Genius Grant. Over the span of Ward's career at the Charleston Gazette-Mail, he's covered stories like the Upper Big Branch mine disaster and grown close to several of the families who lost loved ones.
And they said, oh, there's Ken. We knew the Gazette and Ken would be here. They've always been here for us. And that's just a really powerful moment.
And we'll talk to Karen Spears Zacharias as she describes the sheer joy of hanging out on a riverbank in her novel, Mother of Rain.
It doesn't matter if you're in China or the Sudan or if you are in a small rural town in East Tennessee. You know what that feels like to soak your feet into the mud.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Writers will often tell you they don't have a choice about writing. It's just something they have to do. Often they'll struggle with telling stories of home, wrestling with the need to be honest, while being true to the spirit of people and place. On today's show, we'll hear from people who write novels, short stories, and newspaper articles, each one telling Appalachia's story in their own way. First, we'll hear from a journalist, Ken Ward. For 27 years, he's been writing for the Charleston Gazette-Mail in Charleston, West Virginia, covering environmental issues, coal mining, and worker safety. He's heard both praise and criticism for his coverage, and he was recently awarded a MacArthur Foundation grant. It's given to the outstanding contributors in their local communities who push the boundaries of science, art, and culture. I talked to Ken to find out what this award means to him.
On the website, they said that what you do is you reveal the human and environmental toll of natural resource extraction in West Virginia and spurring greater accountability among public and private stakeholders. You've also won numerous awards in your journalism work here in West Virginia. How would you describe the work that you do?
I think that I try to examine the ways that some of the industries that are predominant here, coal, natural gas is what I'm working on now, chemical manufacturing, and the ways that those industries interact with the people that work in them and the communities where they operate and the environment that they affect, and try to kind of tell stories and tell truths about instances where those industries don't always treat their workers or their communities or the environment in a just and fair way.
How did you get interested in things like worker safety and environmental law and things like that?
In the summer of 1989, and that was the summer that the United Mine Workers were on strike against Pittston Coal Company. And you know, the issues in that strike had to do with long-term viability of health care plans for miners and retirees, you know, issues that the UMW is still fighting over today. And I got to kind of cover that as an intern, which is, to me, was just a remarkable sort of thing to get to do. The joke in the newsroom was that I wasn't on the company health care plan. So, you know, if I got hit with a rock on a picket line, then it wasn't as big of a deal. I ended up spending most of that summer kind of driving around southern West Virginia with Jim Nolker, who was a photographer at the paper at the time, and talking to coal miners on picket lines. And it was just fascinating. And I met Paul Nyden, who was the investigative reporter at the Gazette at the time, who had written a lot about the coal industry. And Paul being Paul, I didn't find out from him that he had actually done a PhD on the UMW. And then when I went back to Morgantown to school, there was a proposal at the time to build a big coal-fired power plant kind of right smack in the middle of the campus in downtown Morgantown, and a lot of people in Morgantown were very upset about that at the time. And I'd stumbled into working at the student newspaper and thought it was a lot more fun than going to class, so I wrote a whole bunch of stories about that power plant, and that kind of brought me into the orbit of all kinds of really interesting people, lawyers and activists and scientists and you know, rabble rousers, and that kind of set me on the path to where I am now.
Where did you grow up? What kind of background? Where do you come from?
My family is from Piedmont in Mineral County, West Virginia. Like a lot of places, when I was a kid, the schools in Piedmont closed. So we moved to Keyser, and so I spent the rest of my youth in Keyser, which is Mineral County. It's kind of, you know, it's not really the Eastern Panhandle. It's more like Western Maryland than say, Jefferson County. And my father was a high school science teacher. I learned a lot from him about the importance of the scientific method and that it was okay to have, even if you're a journalist, to have a hypothesis about what you think's going on, as long as you were kind of try to use your reporting to rigorously test that.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Some might call that an agenda, right?
I don't know about agenda. I think agenda suggests a sort of broader is a little broader than a hypothesis. You know?
Well, and I think, yeah. I guess like your explanation of a hypothesis seems to make more sense while others might call it an agenda. And I think that explanation helps bring it more to light
and helps explain
it to what it is.
Yeah, and I think, people kind of misunderstand investigative reporting. And a lot of times people who do investigative reporting are viewed as having some conspiratorial agenda or something. And really you start off an investigative story with a question or a series of questions or a tip that, this is going on or that's going on. And you kind of set out to find out if that's true or not. And part of finding out if your hypothesis is correct is searching out facts that might contradict it and searching out people who would disagree with it and trying to kind of fact check it yourself and see what's going on. And so I think there's a lot of kind of misunderstanding about investigative reporting in that way. And it certainly is those kind of misunderstandings about investigative reporting are something that people in powerful positions, whether they're in government or industry or wherever, take advantage of those kinds of misunderstandings to detract from stories that might reveal things they're doing that they would rather people not know about.
Along, I think, a similar vein, some folks have criticized your work. Let's go there for just a moment. Accused you of being biased in one way or another and seem to be accusational with left-leaning, but what are your thoughts about these accusations of being biased?
Well, I used to be asked to sometimes come and talk at meetings of groups like the Manufacturers Association or the Chamber of Commerce or, a public relations group would have a get-together of people in, kind of industry and business circles and would want to talk about how we cover things. And, inevitably get some sort of question about, well, you and Iden and the Gazette, you're all just, pinko commie, against jobs and you have biases. And I would say to those groups, well, sure I have biases and let's talk about what they are. I have biases like we should have clean air to breathe. And we should have clean water to drink, and our kids should have good schools to attend, and we should all be able to have jobs that let us take care of our families. And I would say, so who in the room disagrees with any of those biases? And let's raise hands. And no one ever seemed to want to disagree with any of those biases. The other thing I would say about that is one of the things that I found in covering certain kinds of stories around West Virginia is that your biggest fans sometimes are the people who are kind of if you're writing about company X and something they did, your biggest fans are the people who are involved with company Y that competes with company X. Hmm. Or if you're writing stories about the coal industry, the natural gas industry kind of likes it if you write those stories about something the coal industry did that was bad. And if you're writing stories about something the natural gas industry did that was bad, people in the coal industry kind of like that. And so it often I think those sorts of things are a bit in the eye of the beholder.
We've been listening to my conversation with Ken Ward, investigative reporter for the Charleston Gazette-Mail, who's covered worker safety, extraction industries, and the environment for most of his 27-year career. In the next part of our conversation, Ken talks about the moment he learned that he had won a MacArthur Genius Grant. When you first heard about it, what did it mean to you? What does it mean to you?
Oh, wow. I mean, when I first heard about it, you know, they always – this is a big thing with MacArthur Foundation. They like this – you know, they're very big on this secrecy. So I had no – I mean, I didn't know. You don't apply for this. You don't interview for it. Nobody – you know, it's just – you get this phone call. And so I was pretty floored, and I'm still a little kind of – I said to them on the phone – so I want to make sure I understand. This isn't something I'm like a finalist for, and you're going to call me back in a few weeks and kind of let me down easy. And gosh, it was nice to be considered. And they're like, no. And I literally woke up at 3 a.m. that night, and it was one of those things where you wake up and you're wondering if something was a dream, mm-hmm. you know. And usually that happens, like, you know, it's something bad. Mm-hmm. But I woke up 3 a.m. and I was like, wait a second. Did this really happen? And I literally like kind of rolled over and grabbed my phone and was looking through. I wanted to go back through and see this email that I'd gotten from. So I made sure that it wasn't, I wasn't just kind of imagining the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's really been something to hear the way people have been touched by the work we do.
What report did you do that was the most memorable, that, or maybe that you're the most proud of, or that you worked the hardest on, just something that always sticks out to you that you want to share with people when you talk about your work?
Gosh, it's 27 years. It's hard to name just one, but the two things that really stick out for me. One was a project we did at the 25th anniversary of the Buffalo Creek disaster, mm-hmm. that was oral histories with a bunch of different people who had lived through that. One of the people we did an oral history of was Jack Spadaro, the kind of legendary mine inspector and who had investigated Buffalo Creek. Another one was Nelson Sora, who was a Gazette reporter at the time of Buffalo Creek. And along with our photographer, Larry Pierce, they were the first reporters back into Buffalo Creek Hollow to see what had happened. And Nelson spent, I don't know, a week or something there reporting. And then when he got back to Charleston, he had gotten called up for guard duty to go look for bodies. Mm. And, you know, Nelson was my first city editor at the Gazette, you know, and I spent who knows how much time with Larry Pierce out doing things. So, you know, they've both passed away since. But that story was, to me, was that project was really powerful because it had all of these oral histories of lots of different kinds of people. You know, John A. Williams, the great historian, talks about how West Virginia's past is so poorly misunderstood because it's so painful. But to me, I think understanding that painful history is just absolutely critical so that we can learn from those mistakes. So I was really proud of that project. And the other thing that I was very proud of, the newspaper's coverage of Upper Big Branch and the mine disaster and following the criminal case through to Don Blankenship's trial. And to get to sit in that courtroom and watch, you know, a dozen coal miners who survived that explosion testifying about the conditions they had to work under to feed their families, that sort of moment in history had never happened in West Virginia before. Mm-hmm. And I just felt a tremendous honor to get to be there and cover that. And there was this moment afterward when they went to Richmond when Blankenship was appealing the case. And I walked into the courtroom, and a couple of the family members, a couple of the ladies, kind of looked over their shoulder and saw that I had come in. And they said, oh, there's Ken. We knew the Gazette and Ken would be here. They've always been here for us. And that's just a really powerful moment when somebody, you know, says that. I've seen people do that with you. And when somebody who's been through what they've been through, you know, says you've always been here for us, you know, that if that doesn't move you a little bit as a journalist, I don't know, you need to get into some other business.
Again, that was investigative journalist Ken Ward from the Charleston Gazette-Mail. He's one of 25 recipients of the 2018 MacArthur Genius Award grant. After the break, we'll hear from two writers who set their novels and short stories in Appalachia. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Next up, we'll hear from writer-in-residence at Shepherd University, Karen Spears Zacharias. She grew up in a military family, so she moved around a lot. But she lived in the hills of Appalachia in East Tennessee for most of her childhood. Then, during the Vietnam War, her father was killed in action, and his death left a major impact on Karen's life and the lives of her mother and siblings. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Liz McCormick sat down with Karen, who now lives in Oregon, to hear how writing helped her through the struggles of her youth. First, we hear Karen read a passage from her novel, Mother of Rain.
I got my first lesson in mountain ways on the banks of the Holstein that day, as Whedon taught me to stay away from the dark drop-offs in the river, where the currents run fast and where snakes might hide. She showed me silvery Popeye shiners and how to use a jar as a looking glass to find mussels neath the riverbed. Whedon taught me the names of different mussels: monkey face, purple bean, rabbit's foot, and comb shells, and how their names came from the shape and color of the shells. The monkey face was brown with streaks and bumps that looked like the ears and eyes of a monkey. The purple bean shell was smooth and dark and purple on the inside. Whedon said when the Spanish came to Tennessee, the Indians gave the Spanish a string of pearls that was three times as long as Doc was tall. She read that somewhere. She had also read somewhere that mussels keep the river clear by breathing in the dirt and sand and cleaning it before spitting it out again. Mussels coat the grains of sand with some kind of slimy spit. The spit thickens and hardens, and that's what makes the sand into a pearl. It takes years for one itsy pearl to take shape, and Whedon had nearly a dozen of them. She said her mama's people fry up the slimy innards of the mussels like okra and eat them. By noon, we had 25 mussels in our pail, some as big as my palm. We teamed up and carried the bucket back to Aunt Leela's. "Mercy sakes, you two are a sight," Aunt Leela said when we come around the bend with our haul. She probably smelt us before she seen us. Mud caked our feet and arms. We were giggling and carrying on. Aunt Leela was cleaning the cobwebs off the windows with a broom. "Don't go in the house with them stinky clothes on. Strip 'em off by the back door, and I'll get you both a clean change." Aunt Leela stopped to shake the webs off the broom. "We ain't ready to clean up yet, ma'am," I said. "We're going to check these shells for pearls." Whedon and I sat there in the grass for the next hour, cracking open the mussels, admiring the insides of their houses, and searching for pearls. We each found one. Mine was as big as my thumbnail. It was whitish pink, round on the bottom, and almost pointy at the top. "It looks like a big tear," I said. "Ma's people believe pearls are creator's tears," Whedon said. "What do they say he's crying over?" "Us," Whedon said, her dark eyebrows raised, her blue-green eyes aflame. "Creator cries for us and for what we've done to ourselves."
Wow, that is such a beautiful passage. And just for our listeners, this is the perspective from Maisie when she was a little girl still. And of course, in your novel, Mother of Rain, it follows Maisie and a number of other characters and goes back and forth from perspectives. And this, if I remember, this is kind of still an innocent time for Maisie. Tell me a little bit about why you chose this passage in your novel.
Because I think that part of what shapes us is the landscape. And certainly for me, that was true. The landscape, the Holstein River, was something I was very familiar with. Had been across it many, many times and played in it as a young child. And so I think it's a landscape. It's really earth and all its beauty and glory that unites us as people. It doesn't matter if you're in China or the Sudan, or if you are in a small rural town in East Tennessee, you know what that feels like to soak your feet into the mud as a young child and to just know the sheer joy of hanging out on a riverbank.
That was author Karen Spear Zacharias speaking with Liz McCormick. We'll hear more of this conversation in just a bit, but right now, we want to share some really exciting news, real quick. There's something truly magical in the moment when people realize that they have a story to tell or that their story matters. We, too, are trying to preserve a piece of the Appalachian voice and culture before it's lost to future generations. So we're launching a new project here on Inside Appalachia. It's called the Inside Appalachia Folklife Reporting Project. We want to help tell more of Appalachia's story, so we're expanding our team. We're proud to welcome two new members to Inside Appalachia. Caitlin Tan was recently hired as the Inside Appalachia Folklife Reporter. She's a public radio reporter from Wyoming with a passion for the outdoors. We also have a new associate producer, Eric Douglas. Eric has a journalism background and is also a fiction writer. He likes to think of himself as a storyteller, whether it's a news story or a made-up one. Now we're looking to build the Inside Appalachia Folklife Reporting Corps. We want to work with people who are interested in reporting on Appalachian arts and culture and creative people who harness it organically. In the coming weeks, we'll be posting more information about this part of the expansion project at our website, wvpublic.org. Now let's get back to the conversation between reporter Liz McCormick and Karen Spear Zacharias, a person who's familiar with the ways Appalachian can shape you. In this next part, we'll hear how events in Karen's life motivated her to write.
I understand your father was killed in the Vietnam War when you were a little girl. How did that experience shape your writing and your career as both an author and a journalist? How did that shape who you have become today?
Well, I was 9 when Dad was killed in the Vietnam War, which was 1966. So that was really early on into that conflict. And prior to my dad's death, everything in our life revolved around my dad. Where we would live, what schools we would go to, where our next deployment would be. Everything was centered around my father. And when my father died, there fell this great silence over the household where each of us in our own grief, my brother who was 12, my sister who was 7, and my mom who was 30, we each retreated to our own corners. And so the man who had been the center of our life for all those previous years, now we didn't even speak his name. Once he was buried, we didn't tell stories about him. There was nothing ever spoken. I think it wasn't until I was grown and began writing. By that time, I was in my late 40s. That we ever spoke my father's name again. The only person in my life when I was growing up that would tell me stories about my dad was his mother. And speaking the name of her child or telling stories about my dad kept him alive for her and certainly did for me.
Why didn't you all talk about him?
Well, I think, you know, certainly this was a different generation, different time period, and people did not talk about unpleasant things. I lived in the South. It was not okay to talk about the unpleasant things of life. And certainly the South was going through its own growing pains during the 60s and early 70s and having to confront some of its own history in those areas. But it wasn't just our family. This was a culture-wide situation. You have to keep in mind that Vietnam, that particular war, was the first one that was ever televised. It was the first one where a child could lose a parent in war and then get a TV dinner and sit down in front of the TV at night and see bodies being carried off the battlefield. That was a huge impact, and we were living in the midst of that.
So how did writing allow you to process through all of that?
The things a child doesn't speak about are usually the things that they feel guilty about or ashamed of. So for me, throughout my childhood and into my early adulthood, I would meet people who would ask, you know, about my family, and I would mention that my father had been killed in Vietnam. And more often than not, the typical reply was, "What a waste." Well, if you tell a child that their parent's life or their parent's death was a waste, that child will assume that guilt and assume that shame. And when I turned 30, I was a mother by that point. I was also very aware of that this is the age my mother was when her world fell apart. And I began to write about that, about what that felt like to witness that as a child. And writing gave me an order to all that chaos. I could have control over something that had controlled me for so long.
So the last question I want to ask you, keeping the Appalachian language and culture alive is something that is very important to you, and you see that in your novels. And especially in at the beginning of Mother of Rain, you have a note even to the reader where you talk about you hope that your book will help to restore the Appalachian voice or the language before it's lost to future generations. And you even provide a glossary at the end that kind of looks at Appalachian style words. And I want to talk with you just as our last thought to just talk about why that's something that has been so important to you and why you're passionate about carrying on that tradition, that language, and that culture.
So that came about when I encountered Dr. Michael Montgomery at Literary Festival in South Carolina, and he was doing a presentation on the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English. And when I came back to Oregon, I brought back with me that Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English. And as I read through that dictionary, I thought about the fact that my own children had no idea of these words. They didn't know them. And so I wanted to write the book in the language of my childhood for my children primarily, but for the wider community at large, because the onset of television really had taken that language away. And to me, it seemed really important to capture the language of my grandmother and of my great aunt so that when my children sat down to read the book, they would know a side of my life that they had never known, and that they would know their people, even though they weren't raised by my family in East Tennessee, they were still their people.
That was an interview Liz McCormick did with author Karen Spears Zacharias about her book, Mother of Rain. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're hearing from people who write about, well, Appalachia. Next, we'll check in with fiction writer Laura Lee Morris, who's been writing about the effects of the natural gas industry in West Virginia. One of her short stories is called Fracking. Here she is reading from her story about the controversial topic and the people who were caught up in the conflict over natural gas drilling in north central West Virginia.
Picture it, four industrial bulbs, 1,000-plus watts each, trained on the house all night. And it doesn't matter if I use blackout curtains or move to another room. There's no way to ignore the production happening just a quarter mile from my bedroom window. I can hear the workers yelling, the whine of machinery, the wrecks that sometimes happen because drivers are confused by the brightness. I can see the lights through closed eyelids. When you're looking at a check full of zeros for just a few acres of land, you think about a new roof, replacing the furnace that hasn't kept the house properly warm in at least 10 years. You think about how you won't have to pinch pennies until the beginning of the next month. You don't think about the fact that fracking is a 24-hour business. Or that they'll point their lights straight at your bedroom window, then claim it's the only angle that works. For 6 months, I called Jameson Wells, the county, the state, anyone I could get on the phone. Everywhere I turned, I received the same stony silence. So I got out of bed one night at midnight and slid off my nightgown, replacing it with black pants and shirt, black shoes, my white hair tied up under a black hat. They wouldn't see me coming. I crouched behind trees and crawled across the field on my elbows, a serious undertaking for a woman my age. About 50 yards off, I lay on the ground and caught my breath. Then I pulled the BB gun off my back and aimed for center mass. There was a small ping and then a tinkle of broken glass as the first bulb burst. The men hadn't figured out what was going on before I'd shattered two more. I never got a chance with the final bulb. They'd realized what was happening and turned the light from my line of sight. As their voices filled the night air, I crawled back to my house and slid into my bed without anyone realizing I'd been gone. It was the soundest I'd slept in months. "Did you see anything?" everyone wanted to know at the pantry store the next morning. Word had traveled fast. I'd barely poured my coffee when the old-timers crowded around me. For at least 20 years, we'd all woken before the sun and made our way to the convenience store in the middle of town to sip coffee and trade stories before anyone else even thought about starting their day. Miller James, the night guy, always had a fresh pot of coffee brewing by 5 a.m., and I usually poured the first cup. Today, I was 20 minutes late, and the others had already drunk a full pot and taken most of the chairs. "See any what?" I asked. "The lights, Mabel," Dewey said. His grin stretched across his face, his eyes crinkling at the corners. He looked like someone had announced an extra month of buck season. "Someone shot the lights out," he said. "Really?" I asked. That must be why I overslept. They all laughed. I'd been complaining about the lights since the drilling began, showing up at the pantry store sometimes as early as 3 a.m., bags under my eyes, drinking cup after cup of coffee to stay alert. As soon as everyone was quiet, Dewey leaned forward, his elbows on the table. "You know what this means?" he asked. Everyone turned to him. "Someone's finally standing up for us." They all started talking at once. A few hit the table with their fists for emphasis. Dewey always said Jameson Wells didn't care about Brickton, just about its profits. In fact, when I sold the land to them, he didn't speak to me for 2 weeks, kept referring to me as "that traitor" whenever he could. When he got over that, we settled on not talking about Jameson or my land. When I said something about the lights, he said I may as well move closer to town, buy myself a condo. Then I didn't speak to him for a week. My grandparents had built my house, and my family had owned that land as far back as I could figure. I might have given some of it up, but I'd be damned if I was going to move into a cardboard condo. I leaned back in my chair, crossed my arms over my chest, and watched them yell at each other. I couldn't hear a word, but Dewey waved his finger in Dan Morgan's face. Harold Travers half stood from his chair and stared down Sutter Smith, who looked like he might throw a left hook at any second. "Hey," Miller yelled from behind the counter. No one paid him any mind. He made his way over to our table, put two fingers in his mouth, and let out a piercing whistle. Everyone stopped. "Y'all take it outside if you want to fight," he said. "This is a business." I sipped my coffee. Dewey dropped his finger, Harold sat down, and the high color drained from Sutter's face. Miller huffed loudly and went back behind the counter. Usually we were a quiet crowd, retired people looking to shoot the shit and drink some coffee, unless the coal mines or fracking came up. Then, well, then we got told where to go. "They're saying they were ambushed," Dewey added, quietly now. Everyone nodded. No one spoke for a minute. When we'd first heard that Jameson Wells was coming to Brickton, we thought that everyone would have a job and we'd all be rich. Turns out, those of us who own land with gas deposits under it did get a nice lump of cash, but there weren't many jobs for people in town. Instead, the company imported workers from Texas and Oklahoma, people who'd spent their whole lives drilling for oil and gas. The only people who made any money were those who had an extra room to rent, and they could and did charge anything they wanted for a place to sleep. Everyone else in town was still waiting for the coal mines to call back workers from the most recent round of layoffs, or for Jameson to hire on locals at the wells. We'd all heard the gas deposit was bigger and deeper than anyone had thought, that soon enough there'd be jobs for anyone who wanted. We were still waiting on that. We also heard that soon enough those of us who had houses over the deposits would be forced out completely, but I wasn't going anywhere. "Well, whoever did it is my hero," I said. I wrapped my hands around my mug of coffee to keep the chill off. Wearing work boots and a quilted flannel over my sweater, I still couldn't get warm. Summer had slipped away, and I wasn't used to the cold morning air. "I don't give a damn about the politics," I said, "but I haven't slept like that in who knows how long." "You should care about the politics," Dewey said. He was quieter this time, gentler when he talked to me. He'd had a thing for me ever since my husband Irwin died 10 years earlier. Sometimes I cooked a rhubarb pie and brought it by his house. We ate it with cups of milk before moving to the back porch to smoke cigars and sip a nice scotch, but it didn't go any further than that. After so much time alone, I think we were both too nervous, or too damn tired. Maybe that was as far as we'd ever go. We weren't much interested in more. What we wanted was to sit down next to someone who had air rushing in and out of their lungs, blood pumping through their veins. In my whole life, I'd never been on my own. I'd moved from my parents' house to Irwin's, and when he'd died, a few years after Dewey's wife died, we two old-timers were on our own, and so far, at least, we were doing the best we could to keep each other company. "The cops'll figure it out," I said, and everyone laughed. Our police were mostly kids not far out of high school who would give you a ticket for going 28 in a 25, but didn't know a damn thing about detective work. "I'll stop by this evening," Dewey said. "We can sit on your porch and enjoy the night air." "That'd be good," I said. "Real good." It had been a long time since I'd enjoyed an evening at home. Too much light. But without the Jameson people, the sunset on the hills behind my house was the prettiest you'd see in all of Marion County. Conversations split off, each person offering a theory on who'd shot out the lights. Never once did my name come up. After all, I was 68 years old, and I was the one who'd sold the land to that damn company to begin with. Dewey put his hand over mine, and we listened to the yarn spin around us. "Don't bother coming out," I said to Dewey over the phone that evening. Just as the shadows had started to creep into crevices between the hills, a van had pulled up with 5 new lights. Even though it wasn't anywhere near dark, the workers pointed them in my direction and turned them on. I sat on my porch all evening facing them. When I shaded my eyes, I could see they had more men on site than usual, and a lot of them were milling around, keeping an eye on the hills surrounding them, looking for saboteurs, no doubt. I watched them swivel from side to side, an eye on everything, and I sipped at 2 fingers of scotch. Eventually, I got hungry and walked inside, where the air was warm and light filtered through everything. I had blackout curtains up everywhere, but beams of light still shot around the edges. Even if the curtains worked better, it wouldn't matter. Light shone through the gaps in the door and window frames. The darkness was too good to last, and I knew it. Besides, they may as well have been pumping cold, hard cash out of the ground over there. No way they were going to let the wells stay idle for a minute longer than they had to. Suddenly, there was a loud crash and the lights dimmed. People were yelling. I opened my door, stepped back on the porch, and saw headlights pointed at an odd angle, up toward the trees. They came from a truck sitting in the middle of the site, having run through a fence, across half the work area, and over some equipment, stopping only feet from the main well. It looked like it was hung up on a whole pile of things it had run through, tilted a bit to the side. Someone had already pointed the industrial lights at the wreck, so I had a good view of men standing around the truck, some scratching their heads, others yelling at the driver. I squinted but couldn't see him well. I recognized the truck, though, a dull yellow Ford F-250 that belonged to Harold Travers. I sat on the porch swing, all my breath gone. The whole thing looked like the type of accident I'd been warning people about for months. Someone not familiar with the road gets blinded by the lights, confused by the odd bends in the road, and runs right over the hill and into the site. I was surprised it hadn't happened before now. Except Harold wasn't some newcomer to these roads. He'd lived 2 miles farther out and drove past the site daily, had lived in the same place his whole life and could drive these roads with his eyes closed. Hell, his truck probably knew where it was going without Harold pointing it in the right direction. I sat on that swing for hours, ignoring the hunger in my gut and the 4 times my phone rang. The police showed up, then paramedics who shone lights in Harold's eyes. Eventually, a tow truck arrived and pulled his truck off the heap of debris. Official vehicles arrived. More people looked at the damage. More people yelled. Still, the sounds of the site were muted. Work put on hold while they took care of the accident. The lights weren't even pointed at my house. It was dark enough that if I just went inside, I could sleep like a baby. But I didn't. I sat on the porch swing, my hands limp in my lap, and watched everything. "We old guys get confused sometimes," Harold said. He tried to keep the grin off his face, but failed. "Those lights, man, they blinded me, just like Mabel said." He winked at me. "It was just a matter of time before someone got confused and ran straight through that fence," he said. I ignored him and moved to the stand of coffee pots. I grabbed one to refill my cup, but realized it was still full. The guys at the table guffawed at Harold. I stared at my coffee, unable to return to them. On my way into town this morning, I'd noticed more than just his wreck. The official sign to the site was now covered in graffiti. Handmade signs stood on either side of the road denouncing Jameis and Wells. There were at least 100 of them, from the site itself all the way into town. The brick exterior of the pantry store was spray-painted with an X over the word fracking. Jameis and trucks sporting slashed tires sat in a lot across the street. Had I caused this? I hadn't meant to. I just wanted a little peace and quiet, a full night's sleep. Harold continued to regale them with the details of his crash, shaking his head over the damage he'd done. "It's a shame," he said. "No clue how long that well will be down." "At least you'll be able to sleep," Dewey whispered in my ear, and I jumped, dropping my mug on the counter. It didn't shatter, but a deep crack formed up the side, and coffee began to seep across the formica. I said, and grabbed a handful of paper towels. My cheeks burned as I blotted the mess. Dewey put his hands over mine, stopping them. "Mabel?" he said. I shook my head, pulled my hands from his, and dropped the broken mug in the trash. I wiped up the rest of the spilled coffee. Dewey didn't move, didn't speak either. "Finally," I said, "I shot out the light bulbs," whispered it really. "What?" I said it again, louder, and met his eye. He looked away, then back at me, mouth half open. Then he began to laugh, one of those laughs that erupts straight from your belly and rocks your whole frame. Harold fell quiet, and the guys looked over at us. What a sight we were, too. Me standing there meek and red-faced, Dewey towering over me, laughing so hard tears ran down his cheeks. "Never mind," I said. I threw the rest of the paper towels in the trash and walked toward the exit.
Laura Lee Morris is a fiction writer who grew up in Marion County, West Virginia. She now lives in South Carolina. Morris was reading from a short story she wrote called Fracking, which is the first story in her latest book called Jaws of Life. You can hear Laura read the full story at our website at wvpublic.org. Have you ever heard of the Foxfire books? I hadn't either until I started working on this show, and apparently it's a pretty big deal. What began as a magazine in the 1960s featured students' interviews with people about topics like local history, food preservation, and just general conversations about life in Southern Appalachia. Now there's a new book out called Travels with Foxfire, which was co-written by one of the original Foxfire students. Writer Beth Ward has this review of the new Foxfire book.
Just 46 years ago, when the Foxfire Museum published the first in its seminal book series, the U.S. government had situated Southern Appalachia at the center of its war on poverty. Appalachian families in states like Tennessee and Kentucky were living below the poverty line at rates almost double those the rest of the country. People living in the most rural areas of Southern Appalachia in the 1960s and 70s lived without indoor plumbing and other basic amenities, and they graduated high school at rates approximately 20% lower than the rest of the U.S. It was a place commonly referred to as a region apart, a culture literally othered in the minds of the American government and the nation writ large. They painted a picture of southern Appalachia as isolated, white, and poverty-ridden, images its natives are still trying to redraw even today. Now, in the latest Foxfire book, Travels with Foxfire, People, Passions, and Practices from Southern Appalachia by Phil Hudgens and Jessica Phillips, we find Southern Appalachia in some ways identical to what it was, and in others completely altered, by years past, by a people working to reclaim their own narratives, and by cultural shifts, big and small. Hudgens and Phillips may have intended their travels to be a journey of distance across Georgia, the Carolinas, Tennessee, and Kentucky, and it is. But more than that, it's a journey through time. Its essays take readers from the 1960s to just a few years ago. Hudgens and Phillips understand, and they want us to understand, that you cannot engage with the culture and the people of Southern Appalachia today without acknowledging how deeply rooted in tradition that culture is. What does the passage of time mean to a region whose hard and beautiful past has been fetishized by an Instagram culture that's turning sacred mountain practices like canning and homesteading and herb gathering into the newest pastimes for the chic? What does the future look like to a diverse people who take pride in defining themselves by who they were, by the lives of their grandparents and great-grandparents? How do you as a culture decide what to keep of that past and what to let go of so that you can assimilate into the future? What of the old ways do you give away, pass on, and what do you protect when for so much of history you've had to contend with exploitation and extraction, to quote writer Leah Hampton? Hudgens notes in the introduction to Travels that Southern Appalachia cannot survive as what it was. It's going to survive in memory, perception, song, food, he quotes Glenn Kyle as saying, but it's going to be mixed with more modern activities and lifestyle because, as Hudgens notes, hardly anyone wants to live the hard, hungry lives of our ancestors, barely eking out a living on isolated land, often too rough to plow. If that's the case, though, how much does Southern Appalachia have to give away to ensure its own survival? These are the questions that arose as I dug into the essays and interviews and Travels with Foxfire. They're touching tales of times past, often told to Hudgens or Phillips on front porches or around kitchen tables. There's no analysis, no critical take on the memories its subjects share. Travels is just a living record proclaiming we were here. Our stories are America's stories, and we are the ones best qualified to tell it. Hudgens and Phillips' essays took me back into Jane Taylor's workshop, where she turns iron scrap into folk art. Back into Western North Carolina, where a medicine woman still uses curative herbs in the old ways to heal her community. And into Lizelle Vinson's kitchen to learn how to make cabbage casserole. The stories made me feel nostalgic for my own family's history, one that was hard but happy, decorated with open pastures and sweet potato pulling, with resiliency and making do with what we had, with putting family and God before anything else. I went to public schools and I had a traditional education, but the most important lessons I ever learned were those taught around my grandmother's kitchen table as she shaped homemade biscuit dough by hand. And those recollections came back vividly as I read. But the stories also dislodged in me what it was like to go without, of parents and grandparents working themselves sick to get by, of wondering which bills would get paid, and of determining how the union work was going by noting whether daddy opted at workday's end for cheap beer or whiskey. And there is no pretty Instagram filter for that. The Travels essay situated me firmly into that past, into a version of myself and my family that we don't live anymore. And while my past had a great deal to do with the person I am now, I'm glad I don't have to live in it forever, that I don't have to have it constantly retold and parodied back to me as villainized caricature. And in light of that, I have to wonder if our continued insistence as a culture on shackling Southern Appalachia to what it was 50, 75, or 100 years ago, black and white pictures of poor, white, hardscrabble living, or a glossy magazine version of quaint wood stoves and outhouses, is not equally stultifying, serving only to reinforce an outsider's narrative of the place. Nostalgia is a strange thing. Science tells us that a bittersweet longing for the past, dancing around in memories of the olden days, helps us feel more connected, increases our vitality, helps combat loneliness. In such a fragmented, disconnected, rapidly changing time as this, it's no wonder we'd all like to retreat into what we were told were better days, cooking around a fire, sharing stories while we sip tea on a front porch, canning fresh vegetables for the winter in Grandma's kitchen. But for much of history, nostalgia was also considered a disease, a distortion of the past that sought to upend the reality of the way things actually were. In many cases, people in Southern Appalachia canned those vegetables so they wouldn't starve to death, and an outsider's continued reverie of that may not be beneficial to the region anymore. There's an irony here for me, that all this reverence we're paying to a glorified Appalachian past is actually leaving us, not them, behind. Because as we continue to try and pull Southern Appalachia backwards to a time of fiddle-picking and hog-killing, Appalachians are looking to the future, a future shaped by West Virginia teachers fighting for higher pay and lower health care costs, grassroots organizations combating the opioid epidemic, and women like Ann Miller Woodford, interviewed for Travels with Foxfire, who's made it part of her life's work to shed light on Black invisibility in the region and tell the story of African-American families in Andrews, North Carolina. Preserving who we are and where we come from is important work, especially in a place like Southern Appalachia. Those roots, that past, give it a context, and it helps its people claim their earned place in history. That's what the Foxfire books help do. They hold that place. They let Appalachians speak for themselves. But if we're not careful, we can allow ourselves to stay too tightly anchored to old stories at the expense of new growth. As James Speed says in one of the book's essays, Moonshining Days, there's been so much written about Appalachian people that ain't right, and we need to see the truth, whether it hurts or it's good. The true story needs to be told. And maybe, like Hudgens and Phillips, we should leave it to Appalachian people to tell that truth. Maybe what Southern Appalachia should keep of its history, what it chooses to preserve and protect, what it chooses to share with us and release itself from, should be up to Appalachians.
That was Beth Ward reading from a review she wrote on a new book called Travels with Foxfire. The review was originally published in the Bitter Southerner magazine. Ward is a freelance writer, editor, and digital contributor to WABE. She writes about culture, feminism, and food in Atlanta. I can't help but to buy into this idea that Beth Ward's right, that Appalachians tell their own story the best. Even though the story fracking is fiction, the story's familiar. I grew up listening to similar stories around the kitchen and coffee tables, but it was mostly about the tap water. I never really heard my family blame an industry, just a sincere concern about water quality and the frustration of dealing with inconsistent access to water at all. More recently, well, a few years ago, I can remember going to visit family. They'd pull up a story on their phones and ask me why we weren't investigating these horrific stories. Some were conspiracy theories with scary connections. Others were simpler questions about policies. I couldn't get to them, and I lost sleep about it. It's these conversations with good friends and family that are often where the inspiration for writing begins, with our surroundings. There's been a lot of talk about the media lately and this catchphrase of fake news. It makes me wonder how many conversations around the kitchen table started out as questions and ended up on the desks of journalists like Ken Ward. As reporters, it's our job to separate the rumors from facts. As we mentioned earlier, Ward's work reporting on worker safety, the coal and natural gas industries, has received both praise and criticism. Sure, he, like all journalists, select or are given a specific topic or question to look into, and he might have had some say into that selection. But as he and other journalists find these answers, it's not always what the public wants to hear. But that doesn't mean it's false. The unsettling frustration for me is the magnitude of unanswered questions in West Virginia and across Appalachia. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Brittany Patterson, Xander Alloy, and Emma Hurt. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burbs, Dog and Gun, Lobo Loco, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He and Liz McCormick edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories at wvpublic.org, and you can find Inside Appalachia on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.